great pizza and ice-cold beer have in common? Charlize Tap House and Mobile Catering, of course. Charlize Pizza, pasta, and more made from scratch with old family recipes using only the finest ingredients. Charlize will not disappoint when you bite into the bacon spicy Mambo Pizza. Get ready for an experience you won't find anywhere else. Call Charlize today to book their patio for your next birthday, baby shower, anniversary, or any other private party. Remember, everything is homemade using secret family recipes. Be sure to try their famous Sundial Steak Salad with perfectly grilled steak tossed in their homemade tomato vinaigrette dressing. Charlize Tap House, your ultimate beer experience. Charlize Tap House rule number one, come for the homemade pizza, stay for the beer wall. Charlize Tap House rule number two, never stay empty-handed. Charlize Tap House and Mobile Catering in two locations, Anderson Outlets and in Reading at the corner of Shasta and East Streets. Charlize Tap House for dine-in, takeout, or delivery. Ask about booking their patio for your next private event. Charlize Tap House, bringing family and friends together.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
This is not the type of weapon that is used in the average murder in America. In fact, hands and fists and screwdrivers and baseball bats are used in more murders than these type of guns usually are.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Larry Correa. You might know him from the Monster Hunter series of books, but he has a new one, In Defense of the Second Amendment. We'll talk in depth with Larry about that coming up later on today's program. First, we're joined by Dr. Corey Moss, Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College. Dr. Moss, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Speaking today about the history of religious liberty, it's still a contentious issue in the courts and elsewhere. Presently, what do we mean by the phrase religious liberty?
That's a very important question, and I'd offer that one of the reasons it remains such a contentious topic is because we're not entirely sure what exactly it means, what kind of liberty it entails, what the scope of that liberty might be, or even, frankly, what exactly is encompassed by the term religion. You might remember that a few years back there was some brief controversy when, in this context, Hillary Clinton, she might have been on the campaign trail, referred to her desire to protect freedom of worship.
I just wrote down that point to follow up, so good, you're going to cover this.
Yeah, and that provoked a backlash. I don't know that she meant anything particularly sinister by it, but critics were right to question whether or not religious liberty and freedom of worship can be conceived of as synonyms.
Mm-hmm.
There's further confusion because we use a whole host of other terms and phrases very often, at least colloquially, as synonyms. We talk about religious toleration. We talk about freedom of conscience. We talk about religious exemptions and accommodations. And we can sometimes use these phrases if they mean the same thing, but I think quite clearly, upon reflection, they don't.
How much of a history of religious liberty is there? We often hear it's a relatively recent concept in the Enlightenment, perhaps is the origin, but not getting traction until perhaps around the time of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. But what kind of history really is there with that concept?
Yeah, there's a very long history of the concept, and it might be helpful to distinguish between the concept of religious liberty and something like a robust practice of religious mm-hmm. liberty as we have under the First Amendment. But that common narrative of the Enlightenment origins of religious liberty has happily been receiving some pushback recently. In reality, in fact, the first discernible use of the phrase religious liberty occurs already in the second century by a North African Christian by the name of Tertullian, and he is arguing against the Roman Empire's proscription of Christianity and arguing that religion by its very nature must be free. But even before that, I mean, if we think back to Greece in the 5th century B.C., in a play like Antigone by the playwright Sophocles, this is the question that is being dealt with. To what extent must people be free to act upon their religious convictions, even if it might make the state uncomfortable?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Corey Moss with us, Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College, talking about the history of religious liberty. So if the basic idea and even some of the terminology here can be found well before the Enlightenment. Why is there this story, this tale of religious liberty being a specifically Enlightenment and maybe even secular phenomenon?
Right. A large part of the answer to that question is because Enlightenment secular folk have done a very good job of sticking to the narrative, as we might say. from very early on, this was the narrative that they tried to spin, that the centuries of Christendom, and especially during the Reformation and post-Reformation and some of the so-called religious wars that were prompted by that, mm-hmm. simply illustrated the intolerant nature of Christianity. And therefore, a more enlightened attitude to religion was necessary, and a toleration of all religious beliefs. And I mean, certainly, in the years after something like the 30 Years' War, you could see how it might be very easy for people to say, ah, yes, we should not be killing each other over religion, and thank all of you enlightened quasi-secular folk for reminding us of that, and that's what we're going to do from now on. There is something to the fact that even though someone like Tertullian, as a prominent Christian in the second century, might have coined the term and vigorously defended it, it's not necessarily the case that concept he articulated was consistently implemented mm-hmm. in the decades and centuries throughout the history of Christianity.
So what are some of the major turning points in the history of religious liberty?
If I had to pick just a few, I would begin by emphasizing the one that's come up a couple of times now. When, in the context of Christians being persecuted by the Roman Empire, they articulate a rationale for not only freedom of conscience and freedom of belief, but the freedom to act on those beliefs, both in worship and elsewhere. So in those years leading up to the Emperor Constantine's conversion to Christianity and then legalization of Christianity, the articulation of those arguments I would consider a key turning point, mm-hmm. Culminating in Constantine's Edict of Milan, which is a really a blanket endorsement of almost an absolute religious liberty. All religions are going to be free to practice as they see fit. That doesn't last for too terribly long, so the next turning point I would probably identify as being during and immediately following the Reformation mm. itself of the 16th century for two reasons. The first is simply the quote-unquote success of the Reformation, the endurance of these Protestant traditions, meant that Europe was now a religiously pluralistic mm-hmm. phenomenon. And so the question was, are we going to be satisfied with this and therefore allow a certain amount of religious liberty, or are we going to do away with this? And the first reflexive answer was, we're going to do away with it. And that leads to things like the wars of religion,
yes.
Which don't work. And so there is a certain sense of exhaustion and a certain sort of facing of reality. Since coercion has not worked, we have to figure out how to live with one another. And certain forms of toleration, accommodation, religious liberty are going to be an answer to that. And then finally, just to keep the list short, I would come back to something like the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
For the very simple reason that this is one of the most expansive and official articulations of religious liberty and one of the most enduring.
Knowing what we know and having the familiarity with the history of religious liberty, does that offer any potential insights on the kinds of debates and discussions we're having today and perhaps we might have in the future?
I think it does, or at least it might. Let's begin with this. Religious liberty has often been described as a quote-unquote loser's creed. Namely, you only appeal to religious liberty if your side is losing. And we quite clearly see this in the history of the West. And so to the extent that the faithful in America and elsewhere feel like they are quote-unquote losing the culture wars mm-hmm. or whatever that might be, we're probably going to be hearing a lot more pleas for and defenses of religious liberty, both in the courtroom and elsewhere. But on the flip side of that, what something like the conflicts of the 16th and 17th century might suggest is that the allowance of and the defense of religious liberty very often comes as a kind of last resort.
Mm-hmm.
It's as long as one side is convinced we can ultimately win and winner takes all, then there's no real reason felt to accommodate, exempt, or allow a fulsome religious liberty. And so I think that's kind of the stage that we're at today. In the so-called culture wars, for good reason, one side feels that it is on the ascendant. And so I don't think that we can be too optimistic about continual claims for religious liberty to be terribly appealing to certain segments of the populace.
Dr. Corey Moss, Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College, thanks so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, we talk with Larry Correa. His new book is In Defense of the Second Amendment. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
In 1788, as the Constitution was being debated, James Madison wrote that the chief restraint preventing Congress from passing laws that apply to the people, but not to Congress, is the vigilant and manly spirit which actuates the people of America, a spirit which nourishes freedom. If this spirit shall ever diminish so as to tolerate a law not obligatory on the legislature, the people will be prepared to tolerate anything but liberty. Today, we Americans live under many laws that do not apply to elected officials and those who work for them. If we hope to preserve liberty, we must recultivate the freedom-loving spirit of our founding fathers. Learn more about the Constitution at ConstitutionMinute.com.
For more information, visit Hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
Hi, I'm Chandler, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on the continuing relevance of the Constitution.
Many argue today that the Constitution is outdated because it addresses problems peculiar to the 18th century so long ago. And some of it does read sort of quaintly. But consider the injunction against titles of nobility in Article 1, Section 9, for example. Is that so outdated? The purpose of that injunction is to prevent the government granting special privileges for partisan reasons. This strikes at the rule of law, the rule under which we're all to be treated the same. The crony capitalism so common today, where the government gives favors and tax dollars to some businesses and advantages over others, is exactly the kind of thing the Constitution was meant to prohibit. The Constitution is not outdated at all.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. Go to ConstitutionMinute.com.
Many argue today that the Constitution is outdated because it addresses problems peculiar to the 18th century. Some parts of the Constitution do read rather quaintly, but consider the injunction against titles of nobility in Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. Is that so outdated? The purpose of that injunction is to prevent the government granting special privileges to some for partisan reasons. This strikes at the heart of the rule of law. The crony capitalism so common today is a place where the government bestows favors and tax dollars on some businesses to give them a leg up over others. This is exactly the kind of thing the Constitution was meant to prohibit. Perhaps the Constitution is not so outdated after all. Learn more about the Constitution at ConstitutionMinute.com.
Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
The word education comes from a Latin word that means to lead forth. Forth is a value-laden term. It raises a question. Which way is forth? How do you know you're going in the right direction? The easy answer in our time is it just depends on which way you want to go. Young people almost always say that today. They've been taught to say that. But that's the wrong answer. At Hillsdale College, we understand education to be the pursuit of the highest answer to that question. Discovering the right way by reading the greatest books by the greatest minds in history. Coming to see the meaning of three ultimate and related things: the good, the true, and the beautiful. This is the way forth. This is education.
Learn more at hillsdale.edu.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out our website, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. Find radio affiliates all across the country playing the show and older episodes as well, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Larry Correa. He's a best-selling novelist famous for his Monster Hunter series, but also with a new book, In Defense of the Second Amendment. Larry, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me on. I appreciate it.
It's not just a sort of lateral move from Monster Hunter to Second Amendment. You do have a background in guns. Tell people a little bit about your personal experience.
Before I was a novelist, I was actually in the gun business for many years. I was an SOT, as a machine gun dealer. I was a concealed weapons instructor, firearms instructor in the state of Utah for many years, taught a lot of people, certified a lot of people for CCW. I've been a firearms guy my whole life. I've been into gun rights my whole life. And so when Regnery was looking for someone to write a book about gun rights, who also was already a writer, they turned to me. They knew I was into this, and it's something that I really enjoy, and it's a subject that I'm passionate about.
You write early in Defense of the Second Amendment, this book is not intended for policy wonks and pundits. You're just a writer who knows a lot about guns. So who should read In Defense of the Second Amendment?
Well, honestly, there's two main audiences: people who all are already into firearms and gun rights, and they believe in the Second Amendment. And I'm just trying to help them articulate better arguments, and I'm helping them arm them with the stats and the truth. And I go through every single argument that is usually used against the Second Amendment and how to refute it and how to reply to it. And then the other audience, really, it's aimed at is kind of the fence sitters, or people who aren't sure, or people who, you know, they're kind of interested, but they don't really know because they've been listening to the news and everything they've been told on the news is wrong. Or, you know, I have friends that they would love to have a gun in the house for self-defense, but their spouse is against it. It makes them nervous, that kind of thing. So really those are the two audiences. And my goal here is I just hope it helps people and helps kind of move the needle on the argument a little bit.
I want to start with a little bit of current news, which is a new gun control law in the state of Illinois, which, among other things, places a ban on quote-unquote assault weapons in the state. One of the things you talk about in the book is that definition. What does it mean? What is an assault rifle? What is an assault weapon? Do definitions vary from state to state when these bans are attempted? Is there a widely accepted definition? Is that one of the problems with trying to regulate and legislate in this way?
Absolutely. The problem with assault weapon is this kind of a loaded nonsense term. For actual gun people and historical fans of firearms, it has a very specific meaning, which mostly is for a type of gun that's been banned in the United States since 1932. It's kind of a non-issue. Now, the other side decided that assault weapons sounded scary back during the Clinton administration. We got the original assault weapons ban. And their definition has varied over time. And it's kind of like whatever they feel like. And I go through the primary characteristics that the anti-gun people usually glom onto. The Illinois ban is even worse than the previous ones because it actually lumps in a bunch of different things that have never been considered assault weapons by the left before, such as pistols that have threaded barrels, which is crazy. A lot of pistols have threaded barrels. That's just out of nowhere. It doesn't make a lick of sense. It's a pretty horrible law. And the one thing I do take heart from what's happening in Illinois is actually fascinating to me because the governor banned them. He signed that into law, and immediately sheriff's departments around Illinois started saying, no, we're not going to enforce this. This is blatantly unconstitutional. We're not going to help this law.
I want to ask about another aspect of the law in just a moment, but on the subject of these bans, we had a national ban some time ago. We have states that have tried and succeeded in some places with some. What does the data say? What do we know? Do these bans actually end up affecting violence in any of the places where they've been tried?
Absolutely not. That's actually conclusive. Even when the original federal ban came about, they had a big study at the end of it, because it had a sunset clause after a decade. And at the end of it, the Department of Justice looked into it. Did this make any difference? And even the government on its own ban had to admit, no, it didn't. And we see in states that have assault weapons bans, it makes no difference either. And it fundamentally boils down to the principle that, first off, as far as murders go, this is not the type of weapon that is used in the average murder in America. Not even close. In fact, hands and fists and screwdrivers and baseball bats are used in more murders than these type of guns usually are. And then more importantly, criminals just don't care. It's irrelevant to them. I think about it. If you're planning on committing mass murder, if you're, that is your goal, is to go out and cause as much carnage as possible, you know you're going to get busted. You know you're probably going to get shot in the process, or at least go to jail for the rest of your life, if not get killed by the police while they're apprehending you or shot by a citizen. They don't care. And so if there's an extra charge that you can't use this type of gun or this type of magazine or this type of stock, they don't care. And honestly, most murders in America, much like most regular street crime, which is where the majority of our murder statistics come from, the gun is just whatever they stole or whatever they bought off somebody else who stole. The overwhelming majority of guns used in crimes are stolen from regular people, and they're not picky. It's just whatever it was. It doesn't matter. And so a few years ago, I got to tour a state crime lab, and I went to the room where they were storing 50 years of murder weapons and guns that had been seized. And it was fascinating to me how many of them violated various federal laws, because the criminals would take just a hacksaw to them. Like, if they needed to make the gun smaller to hide it, they would hacksaw off the sock, they would hacksaw off the barrel, because they don't care. They don't even know these laws exist. The only people they affect are regular citizens who are trying to obey the law.
Larry, Ronald Reagan had a mantra of peace through strength. You have a section in defense of the Second Amendment that says peace through preparedness when it comes to guns in the Second Amendment. What do you mean by that?
Well, I get right to the meat of it. The Second Amendment is not about sporting purposes. It's not about hunting. Those things are just perks. The Second Amendment is about defense. It's about being able to defend ourselves, our inalienable rights to defend ourselves from everything, up to and including our own tyrannical government. So when I say peace through preparedness, what I mean there is the Second Amendment is the big red button. It's the switch we don't want to ever flip. It's kind of the doomsday provision on the Constitution of the United States. And the Founding Fathers put it there as our insurance. The reason I say peace through preparedness is that if the people are capable of standing up for themselves against a tyrannical government, that thwarts the government from becoming more tyrannical. It's our insurance policy. And so whenever you see politicians being very flippant about this kind of thing, like, it's very interesting to me that they get so flippant about this. And the section I have in the book, the chapter, was actually written in response to Congressman Eric Swalwell, who was talking about how the Second Amendment is irrelevant as far as standing up for a tyrannical government because we have nukes. And it's like, wow. So we have a sitting U.S. congressman talking about using nuclear weapons against the American populace if we get too uppity. And that is astounding to me that they could be that foolish and tone deaf. So I go into the logistics, I go into the numbers, I go into history, and I look at what's happened everywhere else in the world, and it is not clean cut. And it's interesting to me that people who are the least flippant about this aspect of the Second Amendment are those of us who understand just how horrific it would be to push that big red button.
We'll pause there and come back for more of our conversation with Larry Correa. His new book is In Defense of the Second Amendment. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Are you enjoying the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour? Then sign up for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour email list. Just visit radiohour.hillsdale.edu and type in your email address to receive the latest episodes with interviews of Hillsdale College professors and friends. Again, don't miss an episode and join our email list at radiohour.hillsdale.edu. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu.
Not one penny. This is how much funding Hillsdale College receives from the government. Not even indirectly in the form of student loans or grants. Not one penny. There are thousands of colleges and universities in the U.S. The vast majority receive around 30% of their revenue from government funding, loans, and grants. In other words, these schools are dependent on the government to stay in business. And they receive more than $150 billion per year from taxpayers to do so. In contrast, Hillsdale refuses all government funding. Why? The answer is simple. Money from the government comes with strings attached. Do's and don'ts, restrictions and mandates that in small but significant ways influence how a school operates and educates. But from the very beginning in 1844, Hillsdale has been committed to providing a world-class education that upholds America's founding principles and preserves the blessings of civil and religious liberty. Therefore, everything Hillsdale does, from the private loans, grants, and scholarships it provides to 97% of its students, to the completely free online courses it offers to millions across the country, depends on generous donors who recognize how much independence is worth. Not one penny safeguards the college's mission. Not one penny preserves the quality and integrity of a Hillsdale education. Not one penny ensures that Hillsdale can continue to be a beacon of independence for all of its students on campus and across America.
For more information about Hillsdale College, visit hillsdale.edu. That's hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
Hi, I'm Joy, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arnn, on why the Constitution limits government.
James Madison writes in Federalist 51 that men are not angels. Their passions and self-interest often get the better of their reason and sense of justice. So we need government in order to protect our rights against those who would take them away. But for the same reason, Madison writes, government must be limited, because people in government have passions and interests too. Many Americans today forget this. Supposing that we can do away with constitutional limits on government, supposing that the unelected bureaucrats being put in charge of our health care, for example, will rule as if they are angels. If Madison was correct about human nature, this is foolish and dangerous.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
Learning is hard work. Hard work requires character. Learning begins in faith. It must move upward toward the highest thing, unseen at the beginning, God. And freedom is essential to learning. Its principles must be studied and defended. Learning, character, faith, and freedom. These are the inseparable purposes of Hillsdale College.
Learn more at hillsdale.edu.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We've been talking with Larry Correa. He's the author of the new book, In Defense of the Second Amendment. Larry, after every tragedy involving a gun, there is a large portion or a substantial portion of those who are calling for gun control who essentially come down to the argument of do something. We've got to do something. And that something is sometimes ill-defined. You provide a something that is to arm teachers, or at least allow teachers to be armed. How do you think that will help in some of these school situations? And is that largely state policy that has to be changed, local policy that has to be changed? Where does that come into play?
Well, it's going to depend on your state laws, but state and local. And the reason I say this is because if we look at these mass shooters, and these are the ones that, you know, wind up on the news, they're actually very rare, statistically speaking. But they're the ones that get all the coverage and everyone, you know, freaks out about. But if you look at these guys, some of them, they're completely incoherent and they don't really have a method to their madness. It's just the voices in their head told them to do whatever. But the ones that are coherent, which is the majority of them, they're on a mission. They're trying to be seen as famous, as powerful. They're trying to strike back against the system, the society that they think is wrong with them. And they've seen on these prior shootings that if they do something like that and they get that body count, they'll be all over the news. They'll be all over TV. Everyone will talk about them. They'll be on the cover of Rolling Stone. The president of the United States will stop what he's doing and hold a press conference to talk about your manifesto. And so it's kind of created this cycle where these horrible people see this as a thing they can do. And those, when you look at where they attack, they almost always attack places where the people have been disarmed. And as I go through the numbers and I go through the stats and I go through a bunch of examples, overwhelmingly we found that in places where the people are armed, the bad guys shoot fewer people. In places where the people aren't armed, or aren't allowed to be armed, then you have to wait for the police response and the body count is higher. But in my state, Utah, where I taught concealed carry, we have armed teachers in that our concealed weapons permits apply to schools too. So if you are a school employee or a parent, you are allowed to have your firearm in school. And we've had this experiment for well over a decade, and we're fine. All the horrible situations that people predict would happen if teachers weren't, they don't happen. That's not reality.
Larry Correa is with us. His book, In Defense of the Second Amendment. These arguments shift for gun control, for gun registration, for gun confiscation in some places. One of the most current arguments is this phrase, weapon of war. U.S. citizens should not be able to carry weapons of war, and they're largely referring to AR-15s or assault weapons in their words. What's the background on that? Are these weapons of war that are in the hands of Americans?
No, it's a foolish term. The whole weapons of war thing, first off, like we already talked a little about, the Second Amendment is specifically so the citizens can have weapons of war. Mm-hmm. And so we can have those weapons. The other part of it is they're trying to make it like the guns that they're trying to ban are somehow really that different from other guns, and they're not. And in fact, in the book, when I respond to the weapons of war thing, I actually go through how the most common guns in America, for sporting purposes, for hunting reasons, are, in fact, literally weapons of war. The most common deer rifles in America, the Remington 700, Winchester Model 70, all their derivatives, they were all military sniper rifles up until the beginning of the Gulf War, issued, common. Where even, like, the lowly revolver, you know, the six-shot revolver, was a weapon of war. It was issued to air crews up until Vietnam, I believe. And so they make this big deal about weapons of war, but no, they're just guns. There's not really that much difference between them. They just glom onto the features that they think are scary, and they prey on that emotional weakness. It's like, ooh, this is a scary gun. Or we're not going to ban this other gun that just is got wood on it because it's not scary. They're the same exact gun. I mean, literally, you just change the furniture on them and they're the same gun.
Mm-hmm.
It's honestly, weapons of war thing is a foolish, nonsense term. It's just, it's loaded emotional manipulation is what it is.
There's also a movement among Second Amendment opponents to take gun manufacturers into court to, in their words, hold them accountable for the use of their products in these crimes and killings. Is this going to be successful? For a while it seemed no, and I thought I remember seeing a few occasions recently where those lawsuits have been allowed to proceed through the court system.
Yeah, that one is a mess because the process is the punishment. They know that this is kind of asinine, but they are doing it anyway just to kind of grind down gun companies and put them out of business. Every opportunity they get, they're going to have frivolous lawsuits. What we need there, honestly, is more congressional action to head this kind of thing off. But as you see, it's just Congress, once again, is divided based upon partisan belief systems where the left side is perfectly happy to have these industries destroyed, and the right is trying to defend it. So I think we're going to see this continually. And if you look at the actual lawsuits in principle, they're insane. That would be like in the aftermath of the Waukesha incident where the guy drove his Ford Explorer through the parade.
Mm-hmm.
That would be like suing Ford. We're going to sue Ford because Ford created the Ford Explorer, and the Ford Explorer was used as a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to sue Ford. It doesn't make any sense. It's you have criminals taking a product that's perfectly legal and misusing it. The most common getaway car after a crime in America is a Honda.
Uh-huh.
Why is it a Honda? Because a Honda is the most common car in America. So when they're talking about suing gun manufacturers for their perfectly legal product being used in crime, it's the same kind of thing. It opens up a can of worms. It's nuts. These guns are used overwhelmingly legally. And I go through the numbers in the book quite a bit. We have 100 million something gun owners in America. We have millions and millions and millions of guns, and we have 13,000 murders a year. And if you look at most of those, they're stolen.
Mm-hmm.
They're overwhelmingly stolen. They're not guys went out and purchased firearms from a gun store under their own name. Most of these get thrown out of court, but only it takes a couple of these to stick at the lower court level. And the fact that these gun companies aren't that big. A lot of these gun companies don't have lots and lots of assets and resources to fight in court forever. And they just grind them down and put them out of business. It's very, very nefarious.
One final question for Larry Correa. His book is In Defense of the Second Amendment. Toward the end, there are some policy prescriptions ideas. You call for the passage of the Hearing Protection Act. Walk us through this a little bit in terms of ear protection, silencers, suppressors, all of that when it comes to the use of guns.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so suppressors, contrary to popular opinion, which is learned from movies, they're not these magical assassin weapons that make your gun movie quiet. That's not how it works. All a suppressor is, or a silencer, and silencer is actually just a brand name from back in the olden days. They're like a muffler on a car. I mean, if you don't have a muffler on your car, when that exhaust gas escapes, it's really loud. And it's the same thing when you fire a gun, that those expanding gases are really loud. And actually, if you don't have hearing protection on when you shoot the gun, you will damage your hearing, and it's permanent damage. A suppressor is just a muffler that you put on the end of your gun to make it quieter. And it's not even that's quiet, it's just that it's now less damaging to your hearing. And they're basically safety devices. And they make shooting more pleasant, they make teaching people more pleasant. I used to use suppressed guns to teach kids because it takes away that flash and blast and noise, and it's easier to talk to them so they don't get flinching. And it's interesting to me because, like, Europe, where a lot of the people who are anti-gun in America always try to cite Europe, but this is one that they get completely backwards, because in most European countries that allow sporting firearms, they have suppressors are just a thing you can just buy over the counter, no big deal, because they're considered polite. and it makes it nicer for everyone around you. It's actually even nicer if you are hunting. It's nicer for your dog. This is one of those only instances I'm aware of where the government is actually regulating a safety device. Everywhere else, they regulate safety devices to force you to use the safety device.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, the government is taking away the safety device to mandate a product cause more permanent hearing damage. It's completely backwards.
Larry Correa, the new book, In Defense of the Second Amendment, available now. Larry, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Well, thanks for having me.
Up next, John Grant from Hillsdale's Politics Department returns as we continue a series on Alexander Solzhenitsyn. We hear about his thoughts on the Bolshevik Revolution and his critique of communism. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Are you enjoying the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour? Then sign up for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour email list. Just visit radiohour.hillsdale.edu and type in your email address to receive the latest episodes with interviews of Hillsdale College professors and friends. Again, don't miss an episode and join our email list at radiohour.hillsdale.edu. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu.
Many argue today that the Constitution is outdated because it addresses problems peculiar to the 18th century. Some parts of the Constitution do read rather quaintly, but consider the injunction against titles of nobility in Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. Is that so outdated? The purpose of that injunction is to prevent the government granting special privileges to some for partisan reasons. This strikes at the heart of the rule of law. The crony capitalism so common today is a place where the government bestows favors and tax dollars on some businesses to give them a leg up over others. This is exactly the kind of thing the Constitution was meant to prohibit. Perhaps the Constitution is not so outdated after all. Learn more about the Constitution at ConstitutionMinute.com.
Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
Hi, I'm Devin. a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arnn, on what the founders meant by general welfare.
The great preamble of our Constitution states that the purpose of the document is in part to promote the general welfare. Contrary to the modern understanding of that term, the founders understood welfare to mean public good or happiness. This was understood in accordance with the principles of the Declaration of Independence. Such happiness is contingent on securing to each citizen his natural rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Because this requires the government be limited, the powers of the federal government were enumerated, and local matters were reserved to state authority. This was precisely intended to secure these inalienable rights and in turn promote the general welfare.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
We all have a common problem. How do you live well?
What is the right thing for government to do?
What makes a good children's story? It's what makes a good story.
Why is the serpent's punishment to crawl on its belly when that's what it does?
It took 65 million deaths to prove what should have been self-evident.
It's time to pull back and recall the big picture.
We were made to know the best things and to live in light of them. Let's begin.
Learn more about Hillsdale's online courses at hillsdale.edu.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. For all things Hillsdale College, for prospective students, for friends of Hillsdale, or alumni, head to hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. John Grant, Associate Professor and Chairman of Politics at Hillsdale College. Dr. Grant, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
We continue our series on Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and this time we speak about his thoughts on the Bolshevik Revolution and his critiques of communism. Remind our listeners, or tell our listeners, what the Bolshevik Revolution was. How does it change life in Russia?
The Bolshevik, there were several revolutions in Russia in 1917, and the culminating one was the seizure of power by the Bolsheviks, led by Lenin. Previously, Russia, mostly as a consequence of the First World War and structural problems in the Tsarist regime, in March of 1917, it already had one revolution and sort of what you might call loosely a liberal, democratic, or attempted a parliamentary regime, very unstable, with lots of upheaval, and in the midst of sort of additional upheavals on top of the ones they're already having, the Bolsheviks, which really were a very small group, seized power in 1917, and the changes, I mean, some of them happened all at once or began to happen at once. So right from the beginning, you had a extraordinary punishments for people deemed to be enemies of the regime, including concentration camps. And so, you know, 1917 on, you start seeing this. And so people disappearing, you know, people being sent off to camps for not working hard enough, for not, things aren't going well here, where there must be people, you know, doing something. And this happens in waves and continues, but starts right from the beginning. And just sort of supervision of every aspect of life increasingly. So religious life, you know, mostly crushed slowly, but in some ways slowly, in some ways quickly. Economic life. And for years, ongoing civil war was, so probably at least until 1922, there was a danger the Bolsheviks could have been thrown out, and civil war going on till 1926 in various parts of the country, with millions and millions of lives lost, mostly civilians killed by starvation due to the war. So Russia lost more people by far in the civil war than they had in World War I, which was very bloody for them too. So very traumatic. You know, all your old forms of life have to change, and in the interest of establishing what will become a classless society with a period of repression under the dictatorship of the proletariat led by the Communist Party.
So did Solzhenitsyn draw a distinction between the tactics of the Soviet rule and Lenin and the previous Russian empires?
He knew there were flaws in the Tsarist system. But in his writings, he pushes back on the idea that there's a continuity. So it's common in the West to Russia's always had despotic government, and the Tsars were despots, and just a different flavor of despotism when you get with the Bolsheviks. And although he didn't want a restoration of the Tsars or something like that, he thought they had been given unfairly maligned, and in particular defended the way daily life worked in that, you know, and the especially 19th century reforms that had made life getting better in Russia. And what he thought the best path would have been was a continuation of these incremental reforms, and especially with an emphasis on local self-governance. And he continued that argument throughout his career. But that was starting, he argues, under the Tsars, should have been continued. Instead, you had this centralizing despotism, which he thought was very un-Russian. And always emphasized that Russian, it wasn't a Russian regime. The Russians, like the other subject peoples of the Soviet Empire, were victims and of a really very small group of people, many of them non-Russian, I mean, aggrieved minorities, the Latvian riflemen played a very large part in the Russian Revolution, for instance. Not that they were, it means Latvians are bad. It means that this wasn't, Russia is not the Soviet Union, in mm-hmm. other words.
Right.
Yeah.
What does he see as the role of the de-Christianization of Russia in the revolution, in the communist rule in the country?
Yeah, that he, in a nutshell, that was the, you know, of course, it's very complicated. He has a long series of books called The Red Wheel on the revolution, how it happened, thousands and thousands of pages. It's kind of like historical fiction, but that's not quite right. There are historical figures mixed in with fictional figures meant to illustrate how this happened. And so all these different phenomena going on. But the simplest way to describe it was basically we forgot God. I mean, in other words, man becomes God and does whatever. He thinks I can reorder the universe. He liked to talk about this communist slogan, you know, nature we will teach, freedom we will reach, from the Stalin era. So that de-Christianization was the single key, most important thing. And stretching back all the way, in some ways, to actions undertaken by the Tsars, especially the suppression of the old believers, in which he thought was a sort of a turning point. Of course, the Tsars are very pious, typically, mm-hmm. you know, but that they did some things which sort of put Russia on the road to this de-Christianization, especially the attack on Russian Orthodoxy.
How does he think that he can raise awareness? How does he think that he can do anything about this situation?
Yeah, he thought his contribution was as a writer, and he described a writer can be a sort of second regime, and in some of his works describes going to war with the regime through writing. He actually describes it as a desire to crucify the regime. It's very graphic imagery, driving nails into the hands and feet of the regime, which have ruined so many lives and caused all of these evils. And he was very successful at that. I mean, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, we talked about, but the Gulag Archipelago really was a sort of external earthquake in countries where large parts of the populace had been sympathetic to Marxism, such as France, really caused a turning when that was published and got out, and what that meant, what Soviet rule meant. And one of Solzhenitsyn's key arguments is this is what Marxism is. This is not a deformation of Marxism or a misunderstanding. They're doing what Marxists say they're going to do. And so he was successful in that. But yes, as he thought, I'm going to understand and depict what the Soviet, how it came into being and what it does.
He lived, of course, to see the Berlin Wall come down. He lived to see the Soviet Union crumble. What does he see coming out of the ashes, so to speak, of the Soviet Union in the 90s?
He wrote a number of works on this, and the kind of the common theme is the Russia needs to rebuild itself spiritually and needs to repent. For people who did evil things need to repent. We need to be clear, this was bad. What the Soviet Union did was bad. And on a practical level, need to shed the sort of imperialist mindset, especially where the rule of non-Russians. And so now Solzhenitsyn did think Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus should be united because they're predominantly Slavic and mostly Russian. It's complicated, but much Russian. But, you know, the Baltic states, for instance, they're not, and they shouldn't be part. The Central Asian republics that don't have large numbers of Russians in them don't stop dominating them. He thought Russia really needed to turn away from that. He was very disappointed at the attempted economic reforms in Russia in the 1990s, which caused a lot of unhappiness in Russia and very relevant to today. You know, it's sort of a thoughtless attempt to make Russia capitalist by sort of jumping over a lot of development.
Mm-hmm.
Caused a lot of misery for ordinary Russians. And so he thought Russia should concentrate. What do we have? What are our own internal resources that we could use to develop have more liberty, get that rule of law and things like that without mindlessly aping the United States or what some other country's done?
Dr. John Grant, Associate Professor and Chairman of Politics at Hillsdale College, as we continue our series on Alexander Solzhenitsyn, on the Bolshevik Revolution, on communism. We'll come back one more time and talk about his writings, specifically in the First Circle and the Gulag Archipelago. Dr. Grant, thanks so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Corey Moss from Hillsdale's History Department, Larry Correa, his new book, In Defense of the Second Amendment, and John Grant from Hillsdale's Politics Department. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. You can hear new episodes every week on this station, or you can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at radiohour.hillsdale.edu or wherever you listen to podcasts. The assistant producer of the show is Nicholas Alfonso. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
James Madison writes in Federalist 51 that men are not angels. Their passions and self-interest often get the better of their reason and sense of justice. So we need government in order to protect our rights against those who would take them away. But for the same reason, Madison writes, government must be limited because people in government have passions and interests too. Many Americans today forget this. Supposing that we can do away with constitutional limits on government, supposing that the unelected bureaucrats being put in charge of our health care, for example, will rule as if they are angels. If Madison was correct, however, it will become clear that they are humans, not angels. Learn more about the Constitution at ConstitutionMinute.com.
Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
We all have a common problem. How do you live well?
What is the right thing for government to do?
What makes a good children's story? It's what makes a good story.
Why is the serpent's punishment to crawl on its belly when that's what it does?
It took 65 million deaths to prove what should have been self-evident.
It's time to pull back and recall the big picture. We were made to know the best things and to live in light of them. Let's begin.
Learn more about Hillsdale's online courses at hillsdale.edu.
Hi, I'm Elaine, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is Hillsdale College President Larry Arn on the importance of the presidential oath of office.
Members of Congress and federal judges take an oath to the Constitution, but the Constitution prescribes the exact words of the oath only for the president. The American presidency was a new and powerful office created at the Constitutional Convention of 1787. Nothing like it existed in any other constitution in history. It was designed to allow certain virtues, decision, activity, secrecy, dispatch, things like that. And they were thought to be essential to executive power, especially in a crisis. But despite this immense power, the president is not so powerful as the Constitution itself. That is why presidents must pledge to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, and why it is the duty of the people to ensure that they do so.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To join the national conversation on the Constitution, go to ConstitutionMinute.com.
Are you enjoying the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour? Then sign up for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour email list. Just visit radiohour.hillsdale.edu and type in your email address to receive the latest episodes with interviews of Hillsdale College professors and friends. Again, don't miss an episode and join our email list at radiohour.hillsdale.edu. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu.
This is Carl Bott and Ted Leidy. We want to